The idea of the United States as a shining beacon of liberty is an enduring one. The founding of the country in a period of history that featured kings and tyrants was itself unusual. And while we've certainly stumbled on the way to upholding liberty and justice for all, we do talk about it a lot. Our guest this hour reminds us of some of the things said and written about liberty throughout our history. Richard Brookhiser is the author of Give Me Liberty, A History of America's Exceptional Idea. Richard Brookhiser is a journalist, biographer, and historian, currently a senior editor at National Review. His 13 previous books include Founder's Son, about Abraham Lincoln. He joined us on The Exchange to talk about that book in 2015. Richard Brookhiser, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
A lot has happened since we spoke last. Is this book something of a reaction to it?
Well, I think so. One of the reasons for writing it is filling a gap. I just don't see these ideas, these ideals, being much talked about. The conversation is preoccupied with other themes, and I'm not just talking about the daily din of partisanship, but I wanted to try and redirect people's attention to something that I thought was enduring and enduringly important about America.
And you do mention nationalism in the book, and certainly there's been a rise in nationalism with a darker tinge to it in recent years around the world. Do you find the American concept of nationalism at its purest to be somewhat different?
Well, yeah, I think that our concern with liberty, which precedes the Revolution, it goes right back to the Jamestown colony in the 17th century. We've been preoccupied with this idea for 400 years, and I think that is what makes the United States distinctive among all other nations. And I wanted to show this idea as it was working out for four centuries. You said in your very nice intro that Americans had been writing about it and speaking about it. They'd also been acting on it. They'd also been doing things. My book is 13 episodes, each of which produced an important document, but they also produced actions. The documents were the reflections of either accomplishments or goals that people were determined to actively pursue. So I hope it's not just in the realm of rhetoric. Mm-hmm. Something that we're talking about here.
All right, so actions that came out of rhetoric. This is a long list, obviously. It could have been a lot longer than 13. How did you end up choosing the final 13?
Well, I came up with 12 right off the bat, and then I thought, 13 colonies, 13 states. Let's make it 13. I'm not going to tell you which was the one I added, but... They begin. Shall we just run through the list so people know what the parameters are here? The first one is the minutes of the first meeting of the General Assembly of Jamestown in the summer of 1619. Number two is the Flushing Remonstrance, 1657. Number three is the record of the trial of John Peter Zenger in 1735. Those are the three colonial ones. Then four is the Declaration of Independence. Five is the Constitution of the New York Manumission Society, 1785. Six is the U.S. Constitution, written in 1787 and ratified the following year. Seven is the Monroe Doctrine, 1823. Eight is the Declaration of Sentiments of the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848. Nine is the Gettysburg Address, 1863. 10 is the New Colossus, poem written in 1883 and later affixed to the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty, which was dedicated in 1886. 11 is the Cross of Gold speech, 1896. 12 is the Arsenal of Democracy fireside chat by Franklin Roosevelt, 1940. And 13 was the Tear Down This Wall speech, 1987, by Ronald Reagan.
And I imagine a few people going, wait a minute, where's Patrick Henry and Give Me Liberty?
Well, there could be another 13, right? I mean, and Patrick Henry is there in the introduction. I start off with that great conclusion, maybe one of the greatest conclusions of any speech of all time. And then there is a final after, you know, after the book is done and the epilogue, there's one more episode, a conversation that Ulysses Grant has after he's president in 1878, which I think is very interesting. But no, I picked these 13 documents, and then I do say there could be other lists. There could be a B team, there could be a C team. But these are the ones I found interesting to, I hope, get people's thoughts going. There are different sorts of documents. Some of them are very long. Some of them are quite short. Some of them we've all read many times, the Declaration, the Gettysburg Address. Others are obscure. Some of them are setting out principles. Others are plugging gaps. Because, of course, we haven't always been consistent, and there have been shortfalls, great gaping, tragic shortfalls that we have had to make up for. And then three of them have to do with foreign policy, which may seem a little paradoxical in a book about American liberty, but my argument is the world is always close by, So we've had to think of that as well.
Richard, before we get to Jamestown, I do want to point out a couple of great lines in here about our marriage to liberty. And as you point out, no marriage is ever simple.
No, that's right. And, you know, any honest look has to include the failings. My only argument would be that we addressed them, sometimes at horrific cost. The most obvious one was chattel slavery. And it took 750,000 lives, ultimately, to amend that failing. Another great gap was the fact that women could not vote for most of our history until the early 20th century. And happily, that did not require bloodshed to be fixed. But it took a long effort. Beginning in 1848 with the Seneca Falls Declaration of Sentiments, and not completely repaired until the 19th Amendment in 1920. So there was a lot of work of repair to be done. In addition to the initial work of expounding these principles in the first place, and that's why three of my examples are colonial. They're before there even was a United States, or before there was an American Revolution, because people here in what would become the United States, what would become America, were already reaching for this, thinking about it, claiming it. So that's why we begin back in the 17th century.
Indeed, we do, in the early 1600s with the Jamestown General Assembly, which is one of the first gatherings of people for self-governance in the colonies. You write that the language of deliberations was mild until you looked closely. What did you see on closer examination?
Well, what you see on closer examination is that these are people who are in their first General Assembly, which includes elected members called burgesses, and the Virginia legislature is... you know, it was called the House of Burgesses for many decades thereafter. But even though they were formally only making requests and recommendations to the English investment company that ran the colony back in London, when people start doing this, they slide almost inevitably into making actual decisions themselves on their own. Now, this is encouraged in part by the fact that the Atlantic Ocean was very wide in those days. It took a long time to go back and forth. So if people in Jamestown are having an idea and nominally running it by their superiors in London, they're going to be acting on it until they get word back. But it's also the case that London allowed this to happen. Probably mostly through inattention. England was about to go through its own civil war in the early middle 17th century, and what happened in Jamestown or what became Virginia was low on everybody's priority list. So they let these colonists take a role in managing their own affairs. But the beginning of the process was as early as 1619, when you had, in addition to the governor and his advisors who were appointed in London, you had in this first General Assembly 22 men who were elected by different constituencies, and each one was picked by a plurality of voices. And then when they all got together in Jamestown to meet, their decisions were by the same rule, by a majority vote of the people who were there. So this is the beginning of self-rule in America.
Now, before we get to the Flushing Remonstrance, I need to remind people that Flushing is a place. It's a portion of the borough of Queens in New York City now. And this document is particularly interesting because it is from a non-British colony. What's the gist here?
That's right. This is New Netherlands. This is when what we now know New York was owned by the Dutch. They had settled what's now Albany as early as 1622, and they bought Manhattan in 1624. And they ran a colony there for about 40 years. Now, the Flushing Remonstrance, I think, is the one that people have never heard of. It's always the one, when I do the list of 13, that you know, that's the one people say, what, huh? But what happened was New Netherland had a director general sent from Holland. Again, this, like Jamestown, this was an investment company. It was owned by a company that wanted to make money in the New World. And the man they sent over in 1647 was Peter Stuyvesant. He was a very effective and efficient governor, but he was also a tyrant and a bigot. He had a peg leg. He'd lost a leg in Holland's colonial wars against Spain. So he comes to New Netherland. He wants to run it his way, everything, including the religious practices of his subjects. He starts off bullying Lutherans and Jews. His employers back in Amsterdam tell him he can't do that because they have directors and investors who are Lutherans and Jews. So he's a good company man, and he backs off as he is told. But then when Quakers appear in New Netherland, this is a new religion. It arose during the English Civil War, and they are countercultural. They do not recognize social distinctions. They won't doff their hats to superiors. They don't believe people are superiors. You know, every man and woman can have access to the inner light. So when these people show up in New Netherland and they don't have any directors and investors back home in the company that runs the place, Stuyvesant has a free hand. And he sends the first ship along. He tells them to keep sailing. He arrests people they leave behind and escorts them out of the colony. He arrests one man and beats him almost to death with whipping. And then he decides, all right, no more Quakers in here at all. Any ship that comes bearing them will be fined. Anybody who hosts a Quaker in his house will be punished. Then he gets a remonstrance, an official protest from 30 men in the village of Flushing. Now, as you said, it's now part of the borough of Queens. It was then an independent village. And they tell Stuyvesant, we cannot obey this command because we would do unto others as we would have all men do unto us. This is the true law of church and state. Our Savior saith, this is the law and the prophets. So this is an argument for religious liberty. This is before John Locke or any of the philosophers of the early modern age. These are people saying it because of their reading of the Bible. And they're also not saying it for their own benefit. These are not Quakers saying this. These are saying we cannot do this to Quakers because of the way that we read the Bible. And so therefore, Director General Stuyvesant, we can't obey this latest directive of yours. And what was so moving to me about this statement, it was written by the town clerk and signed by three local officials, then by 26 other men who lived there. Six of them didn't know how to spell their own names. They just made marks. That's all they could put on this piece of paper. But they were laying down a very important marker. And of course, what Stuyvesant does in response is he cracks down. He arrests all the town officials who put their names to this. He grills them. He throws them into jail for as long as a month. And they do ultimately crack. You know, and before we judge them for that, none of us has ever been up against Peter Stuyvesant, whose word was law, and the only people who could rein him in were across the Atlantic Ocean. So they did crack under pressure, but Quakers kept showing up, and Stuyvesant finally sent one of them to Holland to be tried, where he got the message back: "We don't like Quakers any more than you do, but we want to encourage settlement in New Netherland, so let these people come in too." And then when the English finally take over the Dutch colony, which happens in 1664, one of the stipulations in the capitulation that the Dutch made was that the residents would continue to enjoy the religious liberty that they had wrung from Peter Stuyvesant.
Wow, pre-1700 we're talking about now. Richard Brookhiser is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Give Me Liberty, which details 13 episodes in American history dating from three episodes before we even had a United States of America, right up to the Ronald Reagan tear down this wall speech of the 1980s. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So another story from early New York, now under British rule. Now, what was it that John Peter Zenger printed?
He was a printer in New York City. We're now in the early 18th century, 1730s. The British had sent over a new governor of the colony of New York, and he had gotten into a quarrel with the local judiciary about his salary. He thought he was owed more than he had gotten. A judge ruled against him, and then what he did was he kicked this judge off the bench and appointed a much younger man, who was a crony of his, to be the chief judge of the colony of New York instead. Now, this caused a brouhaha in New York. The man that he had demoted was a wealthy local grandee, and he hired John Peter Zenger, who was a young German immigrant, to found a new newspaper. New York then only had one, which had all the official contracts for printing laws and regulations. So that was the establishment newspaper, if you will. But now there was going to be a second one, which proceeded to mock and attack the governor of the colony. They didn't mention him by name, but it was pretty clear who they were talking about. And so this goes on for almost a year, and then finally the governor, a man named Governor Cosby, he tires of this, and he arrests Zenger, the editor who's been criticizing him. And he throws him in prison. He does allow him a trial, but the crime for which he is being tried is the crime of seditious libel. Now, the legal doctrine here is that if you print criticism of the government, this will cause unrest and possibly rebellion and other forms of violence. So we have to forbid criticism of the government either in speech or in the press. That's the legal doctrine. Zenger's backers hire for his defense the best lawyer in British North America at the time, a man from Philadelphia named Andrew Hamilton. He's no relation to Alexander Hamilton, who will come along later, but just happens to have the same last name. And Hamilton makes an argument to the jury. It's a long, brilliant, eloquent argument, basically telling them to ignore the law. It's jury nullification. He's telling them that all free men have a right to complain when they are hurt, when they are misgoverned. And if you don't have this right, the only recourse is revolution. So he's saying if you don't want people to revolt and be violent, you have to give them the right to complain, and that is a right any freeman has. And now, as he's making this argument, the judge is tries at various points to shut him down, and he's very clever. He will apologize, and then he'll go on and make the same point later in a different way. He's basically running rings around the judge. that's because he's experienced. The judge that Governor Cosby had put in place is young and inexperienced. And then when the jury deliberates, they leave the box for a very brief time and come back and say that John Peter Zenger is acquitted. Now, the effect of this was that there were hardly any prosecutions for seditious libel in the 13 colonies after that, because the trial had shown that no jury would bring in a conviction. So the effect was that the colonial American press was the freest in the world, even before the American Revolution, and it played an indispensable role in acquainting people with their grievances, explaining theories of liberty, and really laying seeds for what happened in 1775 and 76.
Well, I was going to ask if this is a jury nullification, and you confirm yes. Richard Brookhiser is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Give Me Liberty. Well, the Declaration of Independence is next on your list. Why was Jefferson chosen as the author, Richard?
He'd already done some pretty good writing, a very eloquent statement of American rights that had come out the year before. The Continental Congress was meeting to decide the course of the American Revolution, which had already begun. It had, the first fighting had been in the spring of 1775 at Lexington and Concord. And so we'd been at war with England for over a year, but not declaring our independence. I mean, the theory was we were defending our rights and presenting our grievances on the field in the hopes that the king and parliament would see the light. But finally, in the summer of 1776, the Continental Congress concludes that's not going to work. We have to declare our independence. A committee of five is picked to produce a document. Benjamin Franklin is on it. He's probably the most famous man in America at that point. John Adams, who was certainly becoming famous, is also on the committee. But the assignment goes to one of the younger members, Thomas Jefferson, as I said, because of his public statements that he'd already written, which were notably eloquent. Well, he surpasses himself in this document. And I think what is noteworthy about this, the earlier documents I picked from the 17th and early 18th century were about particular rights. Jamestown General Assembly is about self-rule. Flushing Remonstrance is about religious liberty. Trial of Zenger is about liberty of the press. But now Jefferson is talking about liberty. I think maybe one of the most interesting words in the Declaration is among. He says, among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So there are others. There are unnamed others. We're talking about a whole universe of rights which we have because we are human. They are part of our nature. They were not created by Thomas Jefferson. They're not being created by the Continental Congress. They are in our nature, endowed by our Creator. Now, is Jefferson a religious man? I don't think he was a very religious man. He certainly wasn't like the men of Flushing who sent the Remonstrance to Peter Stuyvesant. But he does say in this declaration that we are endowed with these rights by our Creator, and that the laws of nature and of nature's God sustain America and its revolution. So he's pointing to an extra human source of our rights. These are not things we create. We have them because we are human from birth.
Before we leave the Declaration of Independence, Richard, I want to ask about a phrase that people love to bring up. It was Jefferson's line somewhere about how every so often the tree of liberty must be watered with the blood of tyrants, because people do enjoy bringing that up. But
it's not in the Declaration.
It's not, no. But I mean, in fact, that's the question, is there are some warnings about not being too hasty to get rid of your government in the Declaration, correct?
Yes. He invokes prudence in the famous second paragraph, which is really his brilliant mini essay on, you know, what men are, what society is, what are the proper conditions for such a thing as a revolution. And he does say prudence has shown that people are willing to suffer evils for a long time. And, you know, Thomas Jefferson is not saying, oh, aren't they stupid to think that? I mean, he's saying that's the way men are, that's the way the world is. So he's not, in this document, which is our, you know, our national birth certificate, in a way, he is not an incendiary. The phrase about the tree of liberty being watered with the blood of tyrants, he wrote that about conditions in France, where he had, I think he was there as our ambassador from 1785 to 1789, and I think he was very inspired by the early days of the French Revolution. I also don't think he understood very well what was going on, and his view of events there was much too sanguine, if I can use that word. It was literally sanguine because it would be quite bloody, but sanguine in the sense of hopeful, that's what Jefferson was.
So anybody who thinks that we'll next arrive at the U.S. Constitution is surprised to find that we instead get to the Constitution of the New York Manumission Society. Talk about, if you would, first, what kind of shape New York was in so soon after the Revolutionary War ended and what led to this document?
Well, New York had had a pretty rough war. The British had occupied New York City for most of the war. There was fighting in the northern part of the state. Westchester County was a no-man's land of rival guerrilla bands. This had been disruptive, among other things, to the institution of slavery. A lot of slaves had just taken the opportunity of chaos to run away. And one reason I included this in this list of 13 is, among other things, to make the point that slavery was not only a Southern institution. There were slaves in Northern states as well, and some states, quite a few of them. New York City had more slaves in it than any other American city except Charleston, South Carolina. So, and it was an old institution in the state. It wasn't just rich landowners who had slaves. Small farmers would have one or two. So would artisans. They would have enslaved people helping them in their small shops. So this was woven into the texture of New York life. But after the war, there's this fortuitous alliance of outsiders and insiders. The outsiders are Quakers. We met them before in the Flushing Remonstrance, but there are numbers of them in New York, and their religion decided in the 18th century to forbid its members to hold slaves. So the Quakers as a group are officially anti-slavery. And then the insiders in this momentary alliance are the elite of the new state of New York. We have the first post-independence governor of the state, George Clinton, the first American mayor of the city of New York, James Duane. You have John Jay, who's the great revolutionary diplomat and spy master. And you've got a revived Alexander Hamilton, who is joining this elite because he's had a very gallant and good war for himself. And these men get together in New York City and agree to found a New York Manumission Society. Now, the stimulus for this was that some slave catchers had lured a group of free blacks on board a ship, and they were going to spirit them away either to Charleston or to the Caribbean to sell them as slaves. And this was something that went on. Slave catchers would go to northern cities to look for runaway slaves, and if they couldn't find them, they would just as soon grab free men and take them off. So this was a scandalous event. It had been stopped by the local authorities before these poor men had been taken away. And then the New York Manumission Society was founded in the aftermath of the uproar over this. But they had larger goals in view than just stopping this practice of kidnapping free blacks. They said in the constitution of their society that our black brethren were as entitled to the rights of life, liberty, and property as we were, and that they were given these by the benevolent Father and Creator of men. So once again, there's a recognition that our rights come from an extra human source. They're not things that we think up for ourselves. They're not things we vote up or vote down. They are rights that we have because we are men, given to us by our Creator. And the New York Manumission Society will work to make those rights realities in New York State. Now, it is a long process. Slavery will not end in New York State until 1827. So that's 42 years after this society first gets going. And they take small steps towards this goal. They lobby for laws that will say no new slaves can be brought into New York, or no slaves can be sold out of New York, you know, to try and contain the situation where it is. They set up a system of schools for free black children on the theory that the more knowledgeable free black men and women are, the less likely they will be conned into falling into the hands of you know, kidnappers and slave catchers. And these schools are ultimately folded into the New York public school system. But in 1799, 14 years after the society gets going, John Jay, who is the first president of the Manumission Society, he's governor of New York, and he signs a law that will end slavery in the state by 1827. And Jay is still alive when that happens. He's in his 80s when that finally becomes a reality. But so this was a group that got together both to deplore a situation and also to take steps to change it. And, you know, it took a long time. We can look back on it and say, maybe it was too long, but it succeeded. And it turned New York from a slave state into a free state.
Let's stick then with the theme of people exerting rights that were not granted by the people in power and move ahead to the Seneca Falls Declaration of Sentiments in 1848. It essentially followed the trail, as you point out, of the Declaration of Independence, but instead of the king, how was the antagonist identified?
Well, the antagonists, they are men. You know, men are keeping women down in all sorts of ways, which the Declaration of Sentiments enumerates. Women are not allowed to go to college. There's only one college in the country that admits them at that time. That's Oberlin. Women are not allowed to be ministers of the gospel. Women face a hypocritical social code whereby faults that they commit ruin their lives, whereas, you know, men can get away with them. This is really the Me Too moment, is what they're talking about. And the other point is that women are denied the franchise. Now, this was put in the Seneca Falls Declaration by one of the originators of it, one of the signers, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And she had to buck some resistance from the women who joined with her in the struggle because a lot of them were Quakers. And Quakers were apolitical. They could lobby for social reforms, as they had in the New York Manumission Society, but they thought politics was corrupt. You know, it was worldly, and it was corrupt, and, you know, Quakers shouldn't run for office. They probably shouldn't even vote. And one woman said to Elizabeth Cady Stanton, "Lizzie, thee will make us ridiculous by putting an appeal for women's votes in this document." But Elizabeth Cady Stanton, her father was a judge who served a term in Congress. Her husband was a politician very active in abolitionist politics. So she'd grown up in a political world with political savvy, and she knew that if you do not have the right to vote, you are depriving yourselves of a voice in your own fate. You know, you're consigning your own fate to other people who will not be as interested in it as you will be. So you must have a right to vote for your own self-defense. Now, and this was put in the Declaration in 1848. And when women finally got the right to vote in New York State early in the 20th century, there was one woman who still survived who had signed the Seneca Falls Declaration. Her name was Rhoda Palmer. She was 102 years old. She was driven to the polls in 1918 to cast her first vote.
I love that story. That was exactly where I was heading. I was going to ask you, because she signed the document and managed to live long enough to be able to vote in the state of New York, which is just a wonderful story.
That's a cool detail. She lived all her life in Geneva, New York, only ever lived in two houses in her entire long life. And then when she's 102, she gets to cast her first vote.
We have about 3 minutes left here, Richard, and I want to ask before we go about the new Colossus, Emma Lazarus's poem, and more specifically about the Statue of Liberty itself, because you say it's a challenge as well as a welcome. In what way?
Well, it's welcoming people to a country of liberty. Now, you know, some people are fleeing things so dire that any change of venue is going to be an improvement. But this is not just a new place. It's not just a geographical solution to come here. It is also a political solution because this is a nation of liberty. Emma Lazarus's poem, which is very eloquent, identifies the statue as the mother of exiles. But she is more than that. She is the Statue of Liberty. She was given to this country by friends of liberty in France, who were small R Republicans in their own country and sympathized with America as a fellow republic. They wanted to commemorate the freeing of slaves in the Civil War. They also wanted to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The statue came a little late for that, but that was part of the original intention. So when people are fleeing persecution or economic misery in Europe, they are coming here not just to temporary relief from that, but they are coming to a nation founded on the principles of liberty. So this is a welcome, and it's a very particular welcome. You're coming here to a new and better system.
So you've got some work to do potentially.
As do we who were born and raised here.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, a question about a line in here about the ignorant, the careless, the actively malicious are always with us. Do you hope this book prevents them from, or helps prevent them from gaining the upper hand?
Well, I hope it inspires the rest of us. We need to be aware of these things. Just because we've been concerned with liberty for 400 years doesn't mean we'll keep being so. It's a concern that has to be renewed in every generation, and I think one way to focus people's minds on it is to look where we've been and what's been achieved, sometimes by great men, by famous men, often by people you've never heard of, except that they stood up at a particular moment.
And 13 moments in our history, dating back to the Jamestown General Assembly and up to the Tear Down This Wall speech at the Berlin Wall by Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, form the episodes of Richard Brookhiser's book, Give Me Liberty, A History of America's Exceptional Idea. Richard Brookhiser, good to have you back. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
Take care.